I'm David Kramer, director of the library here. Our author, Rabbi Dov Peretz Elkins, is a prolific author and has had much to contribute on many topics. This book is a very interesting insight for those of us who don't regularly engage in rabbinic conversation, if, you know, people serving out in the community. Some of you may have these experiences, but I confess that I myself have not in the same way. Though, you know, the names were changed to protect the innocent or not so innocent, the details of the conversations are really quite fascinating. And as I skipped through from one conversation to the other, learned a lot about the kinds of things that rabbis might discuss. So I look forward to your sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be here. as I walked around the building, I didn't recognize anything because when I graduated as a rabbi here, it was over 50 years ago. And it's quite a different building.
Ago, this room didn't exist.
Really? Well, probably most of the building didn't exist, right? Well, it's an honor to be at my alma mater and appreciate all of you who have come this evening. there's an old Yiddish expression, before I speak, I want to say a few words. So that is that I have two books here tonight. Only one I'm speaking about. The other is my memoirs, which I've served in several pulpits in Cleveland, in Rochester, New York, and in my last one was Princeton, New Jersey. And the longest chapter is about Princeton, New Jersey, where Einstein and 25 or 30 other world-class, amazing professors were involved. And they're all listed here because they passed through our synagogue. Many were members. What's the world-class Islamic expert whose name?
Goitein?
No.
He just passed away recently.
Yeah, he just passed away at 103.
Oh, yeah.
It'll come to me.
He wrote a book called The Jews of Islam.
Exactly. Yeah. So this book, as my memoirs, and that contains the story of all these amazing people who came through Princeton, including Philip Roth, spoke at a funeral I officiated at. And I said to him when he walked into the door of the synagogue, I said, I've spoken about you in my sermons. And he got very defensive because a lot of rabbis don't like his fiction, you know, he puts down...
Bernard Lewis.
Bernard Lewis, yes, was a very active... Well, he was a long-time member of the synagogue and very, very involved in many things. But Philip Roth got very defensive, and I said, no, I spoke very positively about your books because I really, there was a review by Eugene Borowitz a long time ago, which was totally positive. And I said, that's the one I really like a lot, and you've done a lot of good things. And he got an honorary degree here at JTS a few years before he died. And many people, just like Einstein and Philip Roth and Herman Wouk, we've had amazing, amazing people, both on the faculty of the university and members of the synagogue, speakers at the synagogue, and so forth. So that's in the book that I'm not going to talk about tonight, all right? So that's this one here. Both are for sale in case you're interested later. But this book is a fictionalized discussion among four rabbis. The rabbis are made up. The conversations are historical fiction, meaning that they're based on reality, but they are conversations that I have massaged, shall I say. So they're not, nothing is real, nothing is historical. Well, they're all historical, but they're not taken from any particular source. In the introduction, I explain what the book is about. It says three neighboring rabbis have lunch together once a week. Sitting at the table is Rabbi Don Levin, who's Orthodox, Rabbi Bob Goldberg, who is conservative, and Rabbi Sam Cohen, who is Reform. Some weeks after the inception of the meetings, the group decides to invite a fourth colleague, Rabbi Susan Berkowitz, who is conservative. So there are three males, one female, two conservative, one Orthodox, one Reform. They meet once a week for lunch at the local Jeff's Kosher Deli. Jeff's is named after a wonderful Jeff's Kosher Deli in L.A. where my kids live, and I go there a lot, so I just call it Jeff's Kosher Deli. And they bring up topics. Each of the four rabbis brings up a topic, and the other three throw it around and give ideas. And the person who brings it up has a question or a problem or something his congregation brought to him or his board of directors or some colleague in an email or somehow or other this issue came. And the issues cover a very wide waterfront, really, everything. They're in three areas: Jewish law, halakha, Jewish theology, and shul business. By shul business, I mean board things that rabbis bring to each other that, oh, my board wants me to do this, and my board wants me to do that. But for example, one board president asked the rabbi, would he call every member on their birthday? And they have there are four or five pages in here discussing that question, whether it's a fair question or not a fair question. And I'll leave it to you to read it and figure out and decide whether it's fair or not. But it's a fun discussion. So let me start with one issue that somebody... What happens is that the four rabbis sit around in the corner of this deli where nobody can hear them, and they let it all hang out. Namely, they bring up things that they can say when no lay people are around. Rabbis have a lot of fun being with just colleagues, and they can say anything, and they can bring up any topic, and people can be sarcastic and humorous, and many of them are. There's a lot of humor in the book. And it's a cathartic experience for these four colleagues because they can talk and no board member can criticize them, which is wonderful for a rabbi to be able to do that. When I was growing up in Philadelphia, and my rabbi was the late Mortimer J. Cohen, who wrote Pathways Through the Bible. It was used in confirmation classes all over the world. And the Rabbi Cohen, when I was growing up, he was my inspiration for the rabbi. And he used to say to me, my board is like all boards. Long, narrow, and wooden. Long-winded, narrow-minded, and wouldn't do this and wouldn't do that. That's what the opinion of many rabbis are about their boards. People ask me, do you miss the rabbinate? Because I'm retired now. We live in Jerusalem. And I say, I miss weddings, bar mitzvahs, sermons, teaching classes, all the wonderful rabbinic stuff I miss. Do I miss going to board meetings? Do I miss having the regular meeting with the president to tell me, Chaim Yankel on 54th Street complained about X, Y, and Z? No, that I don't miss. But anyway, there's a lot of fun stuff in here. And the first one I'm going to share with you, you'll see what kind of things the rabbis bring up to each other. And they're sitting around the table. You have to imagine to yourself the picture of what's going on. And there's Sam and Don and Susan and Bob and these four people talk to each other. So Sam starts out. Sam's the Reform rabbi. Member of my shul asked to put up a yahrzeit plaque for his deceased non-Jewish wife. It was discussed at a committee meeting, and it was decided to recommend that the board approve the request. I'm personally in favor of the request. However, a member of the original committee has reconsidered his position, thinking, now that we're acting like Mormons and posthumously virtually converting someone who chose not to convert in life, this means another round of discussion. It would be helpful to know if either of you, if any of you sitting around the table, have addressed this issue, how you would resolve it. I see it as a very simple thing. A Jew wants to mourn his late wife. Well, why not? You know, how would any of you answer that? Anybody have an opinion? What do you think? Should we have a plaque on the wall for a non-Jewish spouse who passed away? What do you think? No opinion? Huh?
Maybe.
What do you think?
Perhaps there is another way to mourn his wife other than putting a plaque up of a non-Jew in a shul.
There you go. My wife, smart lady.
That's why it's important.
All of us, it won't come up.
In what?
In an Orthodox shul, it won't come
up.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah,
you'd be surprised. Lots of Orthodox shuls have people who park three blocks away and, you know,
that's
don't tell the rabbi. Anyway, and they many of them are married to non-Jews, but who knows? Don, the Orthodox rabbi, I wouldn't do it. But I know you have your own views about such things. I guess you'll have to figure it out for yourself. Sam says, I think you're right, Don. I'll mull it over before making a decision. And we leave it. Many of the questions are left hanging because we don't answer every question. There's a question on theology. So, as I mentioned, there's halakha, theology, and shul business. Those are the three themes that come up over and over again. So here's what Sam again. He's the reformed guy. A colleague of mine who's a chaplain at the local nursing home had a problem with a similar group, similar to what went before, and I asked her what she thought about it, and she told me something like this. I think the reason that we were raised about Jews for Jesus is that they have proven to be less than the frightening evangelical group that we all feared at first. Our local group, Seed of Abraham, has attracted a lot of Christians who want to pray like Jesus prayed and observe the holidays he celebrated. They haven't been aggressively seeking Jewish converts, and the Jewish community has not really had to deal with them very much. Yes, some Jews have joined, but around here at least they have not gone after the Jewish community. A few people have found them. I've kicked them out of our Jewish home, nursing home, twice in the 15 years I've worked here, and their presence infuriates me, but we've kicked out other groups too. Nobody's permitted to just show up and walk around talking to residents. Imagine somebody walking around a nursing home trying to convince people to be a Jew for Jesus? I wouldn't permit it. I think most of us now have the attitude that we just need to keep redirecting them back to their group. If the man blows shofar, let him blow shofar for his group. Well, the original question was, can a Jew for Jesus blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah, which is, you know, for sure, nobody would approve
it. He certainly can. Not in my shul.
Not in my shul, for sure. All right. So here's a question somebody brings up about difficult passages in the Bible. You know, there are passages in our Tanakh. We often criticize the Quran because there are lots of anti-Semitic passages, and there are things that say kill the Jews and so forth. And, however, in our Tanakh, we have some things that a lot of us rabbis are not particularly, or let's say we're confused about what we should do about them. So here's what Don, the Orthodox rabbi, says. I have a question about teaching the Bible. A recent chapter I was teaching during Shabbat morning services includes chapter 31 of Numbers. I frequently give a brief Dvar Torah on the weekly parsha and then lead a discussion in lieu of a formal sermon. Chapter 31 is a text that's especially difficult to teach as it relates to the utter vengeance commanded by God against the Midianite women. and the reprimand of the officers for sparing the married women, their slaughter, taking booty. My standard way to teach this is an example of a problematic text, which we try to understand in a historical context. I may also, now remind you, this is the Orthodox rabbi speaking. I may also cite the thesis of a lecture I recently heard that much of the history of religion, including parts of the Chumash, is the elevation and sanctification of new violence to supersede the previous immoral violence. And unfortunately, chapter 31 is an example of that in our Torah. My question is, how do any of you, conservative and reform rabbis, how do you handle that? Any thoughts? Sam, the good reform rabbi, has his point of view. Did you squirm as I did? By the way, Rabbi Louis Finkelstein, who was the chancellor when I was a student here, used to, his answer to questions like this, he used to say, is that the only passage that bothers you in the Torah? He was so clever. He was so clever. So Sam, the Reform rabbi, says, did you squirm as I did when we read that God tells Moses to tell Israel to commit genocide against Midian, killing men, women, and children? Guilty as Midian was, would we advocate killing all Germans after World War II? Men, women, and children? Divide Germany, yes, as Secretary Morgenthau advised FDR. Kill Nazis who kill Jews and other people? But wipe them out completely? Even God promises not to bring another flood after he brings the first one. In his column in the Jerusalem Post, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin struggles and squirms with this problem. He goes back 3,000 years to explain that this mitzvah was necessary at that time. But today there are no Midianites, Amalekites, Canaanites to be wiped out because Sennacherib mixed up the nations and they no longer exist. So that's how Rabbi Riskin, the Orthodox rabbi in Efrat, you all know of him. Is this explanation satisfactory? Sam, the Reform rabbi, says, not to me. Does this mean that we find Midianites, Amalekites, Canaanites? If we find Midianites, Amalekites, Canaanites today, we have to wipe them out? Can Orthodox rabbis legitimately claim that a mitzvah in the Torah was given because of local and current circumstances, but the mitzvah does not apply today under different circumstances? If the Torah is perfect, divine for all time and all places, how can we apply historical considerations to these atrocities? If it was right for them to commit genocide, it should be right now. And if it's wrong today, it was wrong 3,000 years ago. Maimonides rationalizes sacrifices as necessary because at the time of Moses, it was impossible to tell Israel to worship with words alone because all the nations worship by sacrificing animals. This is a surprising historical code for one who formulated in his Anima Amin Credo that the Torah will never be changed. And indeed, he does include the laws of sacrifices in his Mishneh Torah, assuming that when the Messiah comes, they will be reinstituted. What does that do to the rationale of the necessity of sacrifice in the days of Moses? Rabbi Riskin also tries to analogize between the Midianite story and the terrorists in Gaza who hide behind children and Israeli soldiers who are forced to shoot the children to get at the terrorists. Would Rabbi Riskin advocate the killing of all the children in Gaza as well as those used as human shields? Anyway, it's a very complex problem, and these are the kind of things that come up over and over. So reading the book, as I reread, I find myself fascinated by these discussions. And I wish I were meeting with a group of three other rabbis like that every week to discuss them. They're amazing situations. I mentioned there's a lot of humor in the book, so let me lighten the subject after a heavy topic like genocide. I lighten the topic a little bit with a little humorous passage, which is this one, page 81. Okay. Bob, Sam, the Reform rabbi, says, Bob, who's the conservative rabbi, you always have such a wonderful understanding of human nature. Then he goes on, we've been discussing such serious matters. I just recall a humorous experience that a senior colleague related to me, Professor Lazarus, fictitious, our Talmud teacher. In Dr. Lazarus's Talmud class many years ago, there was a student who was perennially late, and he would give Dr. Lazarus a fit. One day he walks in late, and the professor says to him, the next time you walk in late, I will mark you absent. Sure enough, the guy walks in late for the very next class. Dr. Lazarus says, Chaim Yankel, you are absent. Just flip the page. You are absent. About 45 minutes into the class, Professor Lazarus says to him, Chaim Yankel, it's your turn to read. Student replies, sorry, Professor, but I am absent. Dr. Lazarus responds, then read in absentia. So we throw a little humor in from time to time. A very interesting question about the Haftorah. Every bar mitzvah boy has to labor through learning a Haftorah. And if you're like me, most of the Haftorahs are very difficult, first of all, Hebraically, and second of all, the content. They're not easy to understand, most of the Haftorahs. And this poor 13-year-old teenager to be is having a very hard time. All of them have a very hard time. So what do you do about that? So Bob, the conservative rabbi, says the following. Let me raise an issue which I would love to hear your opinions about, the length of some parts of our service, especially the Haftarah. It is long, and people do start to fidget, you know? He says, we do a full Torah reading every Shabbat. I pose pay attention questions between Aliyot, and we have a wide variety of Torah readers. However, I find that the Haftarahs are basically dead time. That's not a nice way to say it, but you know what he means. The lay readers often stumble and hesitate. You ever hear somebody who didn't prepare to learn his Haftarah? Not a bar mitzvah kid, just somebody, you know, we're in a congregation. Hey, Sam, would you come up and do the Haftorah? He comes up and he breaks his teeth and everybody is looking at their watches and they can't stand hearing this chopped up Hebrew. I don't have the person power in the shul to work with and check every Haftorah reader. The Bar and Bat Mitzvah kids are well prepared, but it's often just long and boring. Some people follow in the Chumashim, other people nap, doubtless in preparation for the Dvar Torah. I'm thinking of cutting the Haftorah to 10 or 12 psukim. Ooh. Have any of you done this? Asked Bob. Have you found a way to make Haftorah time more interesting and engaging and competent? Well, then follows a whole discussion of suggested ways to handle it. But you'll have to find that out by reading this yourself. Okay. Next question. Here's a topic which Bob, this is Bob, the conservative male rabbi. Here's a topic which probably doesn't come up that often, but it's very interesting. We're giving out aliyot for a coming bat mitzvah, and we have given hagba and galila to a husband and wife. The wife has a dog, and she says she cannot go up the 7 steps to the bima without Charlie, her huge dog, to help her. Lots of folks say she doesn't really need him. Her husband can walk her up to the bima or and down when they're done. And there are folks allergic to pets who also object. I'm looking for halachic sources, says Bob. Don, the Orthodox rabbi, replies. One of my professors wrote on that subject not long ago. He points out that Talmud's standards for what constitutes permissible behavior in the synagogue is what one would permit to be done in his home. The Talmud states that just as one would not allow a stranger to use his house for a shortcut, so one is forbidden to use the synagogue as a shortcut. I actually had this problem when I lived in Norfolk, Virginia. To get to a certain place from my office, it was much easier to pass through the sanctuary, but you're not allowed to use the sanctuary as a shortcut. So I had to go that way. So this is a real problem, halakhic problem. Right, that's right. However, just as one would allow a stranger in his home and not require him to remove his shoes, so too one is not required to remove his shoes when he enters a synagogue. Similarly, argues my professor, just as one would certainly permit a blind person to enter his home with his seeing eye dog, so too a blind person is permitted to enter the synagogue with his guide dog. I assume the woman you speak about is sight impaired. Well, the discussion goes on and on, but it's a very interesting question. I'm not going to give you the answer. You have to read the rest of it yourself.
Well, that's interesting because I don't want to mention names, but there is an Orthodox rabbi in New York, in Manhattan, that allowed a person to bring in a dog in a small cage.
In a cage?
Yeah, for Shabbos. And this dog never ever barked. Never ever barked. The guy always brought his, I don't know what was his, because he was not blind, he was not anything. Until one day the dog died, and then he disappeared also. I mean, then the person disappeared also from the shul. But I don't know what was the, I wonder if you had the answer, what was the rationale, what was this, the answer to...
Yeah, I'm only giving you the introductions. you have to read the rest yourself. But here's what Don, the Orthodox rabbi, answers. Doggone it. This question has really hounded me. Heck, I wouldn't let a dog in a synagogue on the high holidays unless it had a ticket. One dog claimed to have a ticket but had buried it in the backyard and lost it. When the bima? Only if they had a bar mitzvah. May we all be inscribed for a leash on life. A lot of humor thrown in. Okay. Now, this question comes up a lot. In my rabbinate, it came up, and any rabbi will face. What happens when you don't get 10 people, whether you accept women or not, if you have 9 people, and this guy's come for his yahrzeit, or he's saying Kaddish? You know, what are you going to do? It's a real problem. So the rabbis discuss this. Sam, the Reform rabbi. I'm just wondering how to say to the person who's come to say Kaddish on the yahrzeit of her daughter, in that situation, I count the Torah. If one is there to say Kaddish, we don't. What does he mean by that? Don, the Orthodox rabbi, I must reiterate my earlier reply to this question. I never count a Sefer Torah as a 10th person in a minyan. Of course, he's Orthodox. I have counted. I confess. All right? My board members are not listening here. I've counted the Sefer Torah and a minor having a chumash in his hand. If we had 8 people to make a minyan, Rachmanis on the person who has to say Kaddish. But Don, the Orthodox rabbi, if and when the Torah can answer Amen to a bracha, I will count it. That's his answer. And don't give me any double talk about a Torah scroll being a source of eternal, albeit silent, witness. An inanimate object, regardless of its intrinsic or symbolic kedusha, is not a substitute for a live person. As to a pre-bar mitzvah bucher, let him come after his coming of age, and then he'll be counted. People needing or wanting to say Kaddish are encouraged in his shul, he's Orthodox, to bring a Jewish friend or a family member. or more than one, to help ensure that there will be a minyan present. Failing that, I've invited those expecting to say Kaddish to recite an appropriate psalm when there is no minyan. Well, that's a good answer. Okay. So I mentioned that there are three types of problems: halakha, theology, and shul business. So let's turn to a theological problem as old as the book of Job. Why is there evil in the world? We've all faced situations that we have no answer for, and we really can't satisfy an angry congregant. Congregant comes to me, I'm the rabbi, I'm supposed to give comfort and explain why did this good person suffer pancreatic cancer, for example, in the 40s and die at age 43, right? Susan, who's the conservative female rabbi, does anyone know the old limerick about God that concludes the following? Our God, some contend, is immutable, and their faith is indeed irrefutable. When he does what he should, it's because he is good. When he doesn't, his ways are inscrutable. No easy answers. No easy answers. Here's a really interesting question about a mikveh. Now, I've done many conversions over my 50 years as a pulpit rabbi. And whenever there's a female who has to go in the mikveh, the mikvehs are arranged so that you close the door, and the three witnesses listen at the door for the splash and for the woman to say the necessary brachot to convert, right? Well, this is a very unusual situation. Here's a good one, says Sam, the Reform rabbi. My nephew is a rabbinical student at a school in New Jersey and is known as a traditionalist in the school. He was asked by a rabbi in the area to participate in a Beit Din for conversion, and he agreed. The rabbi has smicha from the Rabbanut in Israel. Now he's being told that the rabbi requires that the Beit Din, which is composed of three males, be present in the mikveh when the giora does her tefillah and kabbalat mitzvot. Three male rabbis in the mikveh watching a woman go in the mikveh. This is a rabbi. I've never heard of such a thing. If the rabbi does not change his requirements, my nephew will refuse to participate. And this is the Reform rabbi talking. What I would like to know is whether you know of such a requirement. Why would this be required now? Is it common in Israel? Susan, the conservative rabbi, says, in every conversion I've ever been involved with where the Beit Din is all male, there is a female shomeret in the mikveh room, and the men just stand outside with the door ajar. They listen for the splash. If they're questioning her then, and I know what the sources say, they should stand outside the room with the door ajar where they can hear one another. They're never in the room with the candidate when she is undressed. This is really immodest and inappropriate. Don, the Orthodox rabbi, chimes in. We've always assumed that our witnessing was valid if we stood outside the door and a trusted mikveh attendant was inside. We know the candidate went in and we heard a splash and she comes out with wet hair. This is all pretty convincing. There's a level of trust that the immersions were properly done. But an experienced mikveh matron can be trusted. Why violate standards of tzniut, traditional standards of modesty? I've heard that some places cover the entire surface of the mikveh water with ping pong balls. That's the first I've ever heard of this. In other words, so the woman is underneath and she's nude, but if the water is covered with ping pong balls, obviously you can't see anything. I mean, you know, it's in the category of now I've heard everything, right? This would allow immersion and protect modesty. Although ingenious, I would hope it would not be necessary. Don, this is Don continuing. Personally, I think I would decline to sit on the court that would expect me to be inside. I would not be comfortable with that. The candidate needs to be comfortable, and so do we. You ask, do you know such a requirement? Of course, Judaism never trusted the testimony of women. That's in the history of Chazal. Therefore, other women place the giorit in water up to her neck, and two Talmidei Chachamim stand outside. Supposedly, they can see only her head above the water and not the rest of her body. This is from the Talmud, Swords of Amot 47b. I spoke with two Orthodox rabbis in Israel, and they allow the giorit to wear a very loose robe when entering the mikveh so she doesn't feel embarrassed. Well, there are all kinds of solutions to the problem, and and obviously this nephew decides that he's not going to accept it. See how we do. I want to leave some time for questions, so I'll take one or two more things. You know, another problem that's come up probably in the last 10 years of my pulpit rabbinate, people have cell phones and they ring. And, you know, I married my daughter in Israel about 20 years ago. She had a civil wedding in the States by a justice of the peace. And so she was already legally married. So a conservative rabbi in Israel can perform a Jewish ceremony without worrying about the chief rabbin because, you know, she's really already married. So while I was performing the ceremony, cell phones start going off. And I thought, I'm marrying my daughter here. I thought I would have a fit. But this is a problem that rabbis face today. And how do you tell people not to do that? Well, Sam, the Reform rabbi, has a great thing that he starts off his services with. Here's what he says. Number one, turn off your cell phone. God will not call you on Shabbat. Two, on Shabbat, the best pictures are taken with the eyes, so no smartphone photos. Three, please talk to God, not to your neighbor. These are rules for behavior in a shul. Four, wrong address. This is a holy place. The disco is two blocks away. Five, bar mitzvah doesn't mean you're in a bar. That's the way he begins the service to make sure people behave themselves. Another problem that comes up a lot is people who move away from the synagogue, and when they die, they want to be buried in the synagogue cemetery. Well, the people who have supported the cemetery have been paying dues, lots of dues. Today, in my shul in Princeton, New Jersey, it's like $2,000 for a couple. It's a lot of money. So if they moved to Florida, you know, 10 years ago before death, they're not going to continue to pay the $2,000 to Princeton, New Jersey. But so they're not members. And the rule is if you want to be buried in our local cemetery, then you have to be a member. So what do you do? So there are all kinds of special memberships. And one guy decides to get a little cute. And this is what he says. Okay, any of you have a membership category for those who only have cemetery plots? We call it a cemetery-only membership. I'm looking for an alternative category name. People walk around saying they are cemetery-only members of Congregation Beth Shalom. It's not really good marketing for your synagogue, he says. Don, so Don, who's the smart aleck, the Orthodox rabbi, is a bit of a smart aleck, and with three other rabbis sitting around a table, you can be a little smart alecky. He said, well, how about the Walking Dead? Or How about an afterlifetime membership? Or deadheads, members in perpetuity, real estate members, landholders, members in good repose, a Jewish underground membership. They're kibitzing with one another. And then there's a whole discussion, which I won't go into, about somebody wants to get a Hebrew name after going through a transgender procedure. So they were Chaim, and now they want to be called Chaya, and they want their name to be announced from the Bima. So how do you handle that? Well, I won't go into it, but there's a whole discussion. And then finally, at the end, one rabbi comes up and says, you know, we're four rabbis, and in the next town, there's another four rabbis, and they want to join our group. So let's meet next week, and we'll discuss and decide that. And that's how the book ends. So, time for your questions. Please.
Do you bring sources when rabbis base their opinion on the sources? Do you bring references?
Yeah, there are a lot of sources in here from the Talmud and from the Shulchan Aruch and other places. It's all in here. All sourced. Right. Right.
Who did you see the audience as being, the readership for this?
That's a good question. The basis of the whole thing is that many people have told me over the years that lay people would love to know what the rabbis talk about when they're alone. And I say, well, you like to be a fly on the wall, read this book. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's for lay people mm-hmm. who are just anxious to get a little bit of an inside view of what being a rabbi is all about.
And as a rabbi writing for a lay audience about the way rabbis talk,
right.
Did you have something that you want, like an image you wanted to project or something you wanted to prove to the readers about who rabbis are? You understand what I'm asking?
Because
there are stereotypes that go both ways.
That's true. One thing I want people to realize is that rabbis are human and they have a lot of humor. And they have sarcasm, mm-hmm. and they have nastiness, mm-hmm. and it's just playfulness, and that's sprinkled. I would say it's 5% of the book, but it's sprinkled around, mm-hmm. so people know rabbis talk about everything, and they're human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think lay people want to know how the serious questions get resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And with four serious rabbis trying to figure it out, to go back to their board or their congregant or somebody and give a decent, intelligent answer, you know, you'll see a lot of debate and not necessarily an easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people to realize that these are eternal questions that are constantly question of evil. The question of the Messiah, that's not part of discussion in here. Question of heaven and hell. These theological questions are debated over and over again, and no easy answers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very often a congregant will say, Rabbi, what's the Jewish view of X, Y, and Z? I say, well, you have to tell me which century, which mm-hmm. country, what year, and so forth. Because mm-hmm. there's no Jewish view of boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm.
There's 7th century Spain answer, there's 14th century German answer, there's 21st century Reform answer, you know. So I want people to get the sense of what Jewish law is really all about.
Mm-hmm.
And Jewish theology is the same. And so there's lots of different things that they'll gain from this. Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
Having been a pulpit rabbi in America and now living in Israel, uh-huh. do you find any significant differences?
Oh, my goodness. The question should be, is there anything the same?
Okay.
my wife would be better probably answer than I could about that. We live in Jerusalem. We think that's the only place to live in Israel, if you're living in Israel. I have a son who lives in Tel Aviv. He's married with three little granddaughters, and we go there once a week and have dinner with them and visit them. But it feels like we're going to Paris, you know. And we have another son who lives in Jerusalem who's an Orthodox rabbi. He calls it Smell of Eve. It's so different, such a different atmosphere. Israel is a land of contrasts, you know, from geography, topography, theology, everything.
But you were asking about between the United States and Israel, right?
Yeah, yeah. Jerusalem's such a holy city. And I'll give you an example, a couple of examples. We live in a high-rise building, 23 floors, and we live on the 21st floor. And I got on the elevator one day, and it was packed full of people. There must have been a dozen people in the elevator, no room at all for anybody else. There's a woman out at the door of the elevator with a baby carriage, and she's anxious to get in and get up to her apartment, and there's no room. The woman in the back of the elevator quotes from Pirkei Avot, you know, in the Torah, you're commanded three times a year to go to Jerusalem to bring your sacrifices. And in Pirkei Avot, it says, there was never a time when somebody said, there's no room in Jerusalem for another person to sleep. It says in Pirkei Avot. This woman in the back of the elevator says, quotes from Pirkei Avot, there's never been a time when somebody said, there's no room. They found room, she came in. Now, would you find that on Park Avenue? Somebody quoting Pirkei Avot? I don't think so. I was walking home one day from the Shuk. We live very close to Machane Yehuda, you know, Jerusalem?
We were just there.
Okay. So Machane Yehuda is a block away. And I'm walking home with two very heavy bags. And I'm schlepping. It's a hot day. This little 15-year-old yeshiva bacher walks over to me. He says, Adoni, afshar lazor lecha? Can I help you, sir? I said, oh boy, you're a blessing from heaven. He takes my bags and walks me all the way to my door. And To the elevator. I knew he wouldn't take any money for it. So I said, look, I took out some coins. I said, please, the next time you have an opportunity, put this in your tzedakah for me. All right. Things like that happen all the time in Jerusalem. All the time.
The scale.
Yeah. Well, there are several other examples I could give you. We were in a nightclub in Tel Aviv once, and Tel Aviv is a very secular, non-religious city. And all of a sudden, it was December, and the lights go out, and it's pitch black, and they're all secular, no kippot, nobody's doing anything. And the bartender says, okay, we're going to light the Hanukkah candles. And in the dark, the lights the Hanukkah candles, and start. Everybody in the room starts chanting the brachot. These are the kind of things, it's a totally different atmosphere, and it's wonderful. You see people walking this way and that way, carrying talisim, wearing talisim, and it's, somebody once said, Judaism is the default in Israel, and that's a good way to sum it up. Another person said to me, we live in Jerusalem because when the Messiah comes, we want a front row seat. I mean, it's such holiness in that wonderful city. And we live on the 21st floor, and our balcony, we look out and we see the whole city of Jerusalem. I get up in the morning and I have hanging on the wall right next to the mirpeset, the terrace, this wool hanging in silver. Imesh from Psalms, Imesh Kachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its cunning. I wake up in the morning, I read that sign, I look out the window, and I see the city of Jerusalem. In Princeton, it never happened. Other questions? Well, again.
Well, that's a nice note to end on. In Princeton, it never happened.
It never happened. Although, my wife always quotes this one. People say, why did you move from Princeton? Princeton is academia heaven, really. I mean, you read this memoir thing, and the most famous people in the world come through my shul, not only the town, the university, but my shul. And academia heaven, how could you leave academia heaven? So my wife says, well, there's academia heaven, and then there's holy heaven. And that's Jerusalem.
Which would you choose?
Which would you choose? So we've been living there 4 years. We love it.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for presenting about the very interesting questions you engaged, and thank you for coming.